This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Has your doctor talked to you about climate change? If that sounds strange, you need this program, because climate change is the new tobacco. I'll be talking with emergency physician Jay Lemery from Colorado about his new book, Enviromedics. Then we're off to the UK, where Nicola Wheeler from the famous medical journal The Lancet explains their Climate Countdown 2017 and how doctors are getting involved. But first, the granddaddy of climate change science, Dr. James Hansen, recorded at the COP23 climate conference recently in Bonn, Germany.
Hello, and thank you for coming to another Climate Matters press conference. I'm the executive director of the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. My name's Stuart Scott, and I'm the host of these programs. And we're coming to you live from Bonn, Germany, COP23. I like to give my email address at the beginning and end of each show so that people can write me afterwards with any questions or comments. Now, today's guests with me are three: Dr. James Hansen, former director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, currently the director of Climate Science, Awareness, and Solutions Program at Columbia University's Earth Institute, and Pam Pearson, founder and director of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative. On my right, Dr. Philip Duffy, who's the president and executive director of the Woods Hole Research Center in Massachusetts. He's also former senior advisor to the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Today's show we're calling Scientific Reticence, a Threat to Humanity and Nature. Dr. Hansen, would you start us off?
Yeah, that title, I think, is directed to my fellow scientists and also to the negotiators at this climate conference and to the public. Richard Feynman, who I would say is the second greatest physicist of the 20th century, liked to poke fun at his fellow physicists about, I'm not sure he used the word reticence, but there was this famous Millikan's oil drop experiment, which was designed to measure the electron charge. And it got an answer which we now know was not quite right, because he didn't have the right viscosity of air in the calculation. But his fellow scientists, as they did their experiments and were getting a different answer than Millikan, just moved the value a little bit away from Millikan's, and then they would move it a little further and a little further. And after enough years, they finally got to the right answer. But there is a reticence to challenge the expert number. I use this as an example. In 2005 and 2007, when I heard from glaciologists, you know, they were beginning to get really worried about the stability of the ice sheets and the threat that they posed to sea level. And yet, you didn't hear that in public. And the IPCC documents had little, if any, contribution from the ice sheets. So I wrote an article about that. But the problem is we don't have decades to come to the right answer. We need to understand that. So, you know, we now know that the temperature rise of the past few decades has raised global temperature far above the prior level in the Holocene, the last 11,000 years during which civilization developed. And in fact, the temperature now is comparable to the maximum temperature in the Eemian, 120,000 years ago, when sea level was 6 to 9 meters higher. Now, the temperature over the last 50 years has been rising almost linearly, and that's brought us to this high level, well above prior Holocene temperatures. Why has it increased almost linearly. The planet is out of energy balance. There's more energy coming in than going out as heat radiation. Because the increasing greenhouse gases are like a blanket, they reduce the heat radiation to space. And the warming would then bring the planet back to energy balance, except we keep adding more gases to the atmosphere at a rate indicated in this chart of about 0.04 watts per meter squared per year. And that has been more or less constant for the last several decades. Now, IPCC has added to their scenarios RCP 2.6, which is designed to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And based on what I showed you already about how warm the planet has already become relative to the Eemian, we really need at most to have global warming of 1.5 degrees. But what's happening is this has no relation to reality. The reality is that climate forcings are not only continuing to increase, but even increase faster. So there's a gap already between the real world and the 1.5 degree scenario. Well, we could do something about that gap. We could say, okay, let's suck some CO2 out of the atmosphere. Well, with the estimated cost of $150 to $350 per ton, at the low end of that range, you're talking about $600 billion to remove the excess of just 1 year's emissions. Or if it's $350 a ton, it's $1.4 trillion. Now, you can compare that, just if you don't know what $1 trillion is, the global military budget is one last 2015 was $1.7 trillion. The United States military budget, $600 billion. We're not going to spend $1 trillion every year to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. So what we're doing instead is handing young people a situation that's beginning to run out of control. And we have to recognize, you know, scientists are trained to understand, to analyze complex problems. And as we look at this problem, we need to look at the whole picture and make sure that the negotiators and the public understand the situation. The Kyoto Protocol in 1997 was intended to reduce emissions. But you see that even the developed world, the mature economies, all that happened is their emissions have flattened out. And that happened already by 1980, they had flattened out. Kyoto Protocol, where you have each country has a goal, 195 different goals, simply is not effective. And you can see what's happening in the real world. This 1.5 degree scenario requires that emissions be decreased rapidly. It's the equivalent of 3% per year decrease in emissions, plus extracting some CO2 from the air with improved agricultural and forestry practices. And this is simply not happening. The fundamental thing is, and on our recent papers, I have economists as co-authors. It's well understood that as long as fossil fuels remain cheap, we're not going to phase them out. And each country saying, well, we'll try to do better. And we'll maybe increase our targets next year or next decade or 2 decades downstream. That simply has no effect. We've proven that with the Kyoto Protocol. What you have to do is make the price of fossil fuels include their cost to society. That includes air pollution, water pollution, climate change. And if you do that, then we can move to alternatives like renewable energies, energy efficiency, nuclear power. Let everything compete. But as long as we don't make fossil fuels pay their cost to society, we're not going to solve the problem. And so we can't pretend that we're doing that. And we can see this. The scientists should be standing up, and, in my opinion, and telling the public and telling negotiators, you know, you have to do something that actually has an impact.
So the reticence is really that scientists are not going out of there strictly informational, and they're not telling what their gut feel is?
Yeah, I think that's right, that the scientists who have looked at this whole problem have got to look at the data. I mean, that's what science is, a case of looking at data and explaining the data. Your theories have to fit the data. And the theory that you can solve this problem without a rising price on carbon has no foundation whatever.
And here are a couple of snippets of the talk given at that same conference by Pam Peterson, the founder and director of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative.
The cryosphere has been called a canary in a coal mine, but it is becoming a driver of climate very, very rapidly, and in many ways an irreversible driver of climate. Regional and seasonal temperatures, for example, the Arctic, although we're looking at, say, a global mean temperature of 2 degrees, in the summer, the Arctic is projected to be at about 9 degrees, and in the winter months, 12 degrees C over current temperatures.
And 12 C equates to what, about 20 C?
Exactly.
20 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, Fahrenheit. So, in other words, the winter temperatures are rising higher than the summer temperatures, which are rising much higher than global mean temperature.
I remember it was raining in the Arctic on New Year's Day a couple of years ago.
Yeah. It's going very, very quickly there. And at times, unfortunately, when the cold air is down over the middle latitudes, giving a false sense that, you know, things maybe aren't that bad, when it's actually that the heat is being displaced, in a sense, up to the Arctic. So overshoot scenarios, as are being discussed, hold much greater risk. And the other issue is that 2100 is, in many ways, a very misleading goal. A lot of the data that you see stops in 2100, but for sea level rise in particular, that is just the beginning. And the worst is that it is locked in.
That's all the time that we can play from that 24-minute press conference, and I'll tell you how to find out more in just a minute. Stuart Scott faithfully gathers the bright lights at every major climate conference. He's from the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. This press conference was in Bonn, Germany, live from the COP23 conference. Find a link to the full 24-minute thing in my show blog at ecoshock.org, or visit upfsi.org for more videos. Look for Climate Matters TV. Now, let the doctors speak. Imagine getting a diagnosis of cancer, but your doctor doesn't tell you cigarettes are causing it and you should quit. Those days are over. Doctors spoke out about tobacco. But every year, millions of people get sicker or die because of climate change. Where are the doctors saying climate change is a major illness? That is one of the many important questions asked by Drs. Jay Lemery from the University of Colorado School of Medicine and Paul Orbach from the Stanford School of Medicine. They just released an important new book, Enviromedics: The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. Jay Lemery, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be here.
Your co-author, Paul Orbach, literally wrote the book on wilderness medicine. In fact, a 7th edition textbook on that just came out this year, I see. How did you two connect?
So I was a member of the Wilderness Medical Society early in my career. I finished residency about 2004. And I met Paul through our mutual connection with the WMS. And then actually, I went on a trek with Paul to visit some friends who were doing work at the Everest Base Camp Medical Clinic. So we trekked up in Nepal, and we were on the road, you know, on the trail together for about 2 to 3 weeks. So we became good friends, and then really started to shortly thereafter talk about these issues. And you know, honestly, we started talking about the conspicuous absence of healthcare providers in the larger conversations of climate change and health.
Yeah, it's a huge field. Just the table of contents of your new book, Enviromedics, seems daunting. There's so many impacts. I mean, there's obvious things like heat stroke, but then there's the strange illnesses from insects and algae. How did you two manage to sort out those threats and prioritize them for the book?
Yeah, I mean, so what we really wanted to do is kind of take the conversation to the bedside and talk to people from a clinician's point of view. And so we took the best evidence that's out there. And in some ways, the book is an inventory of what the most likely impacts of climate change on health are. And we wanted to clarify, dispel myths, and then actually talk about what it really is like for a human to have these ailments. And I think that's the clinical voice we wanted to use, because I think science hasn't done a very good job of clarifying exactly what the risks are. You know, often things are couched in public health terms. So talking about, you know, huge populations, 100,000 people, often it's couched in altruism, you know, save the polar bears, love Mother Earth, or abstractions, you know, 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. What does that mean for most people? So we really kind of wanted to go, for lack of a better term, brass tacks and say, look, this is an asthma exacerbation. This is what it feels like. This is how climate change triggers it, or can be a factor in triggering it. And really kind of, again, sort of bring people and give a visceral sense of the illnesses and the pathology that's at stake.
Well, you're an emergency clinician. Do you actually see cases that you would say that climate change is a factor even in Colorado?
Well, we know, right? We know that extreme heat and extreme weather are all threat multipliers for disease and illness. I mean, that's what we cover in the book. So what we did is Paul's emergency physician as well, we put together composite patients from our career and say, you know, this is what we're talking about. This is what, you know, shortness of breath from degraded air quality on a hot day looks like, you know, an asthma exacerbation or someone with devastating diarrheal illness from an extreme weather event and flooding event, things like that. So, you know, there was no particular patient that we cited, but we put together composite patients based on our understanding of these risks and the pathology that we see every day in emergency departments.
You know, we just had a whole wave of wildfires here in the West, and I had friends, seniors, that just couldn't go outside for most of the summer, and a couple of those ended up in the emergency ward.
Yeah, I mean, there's the thing about climate change is it's really a disease of vulnerability, right? So it's people that, you know, the very young, the very old, people that are sick, socioeconomic vulnerabilities, those are the ones that are going to be bearing the brunt of this. Worldwide, it's going to be places that have very poor infrastructure, poor governance, places with lots of poverty that are going to be disproportionately affected. And this is where a lot of the research is now coming out, is that when you have big wildfires and air quality is degraded over huge swaths of the North American continent, for instance, you know, people are going to suffer. And particularly those that have pre-existing lung disease, who we call it, they have, you know, tenuous physiology already, they're the ones that are going to end up being the most susceptible to illness and the ones that are ultimately going to be showing up in the emergency departments.
And I'm thinking of people in Malaysia, too, when the big fires in Indonesia are blowing smoke over most of East Asia for periods. I'll be talking with other experts about heat deaths, but I wanted to zero in on one of the chapters in your book. It's about vector-borne diseases. And are we talking about Zika? Are we talking about dengue fever or what?
Yeah, so, you know, when you think about that, we think about mosquitoes and ticks. And what we know is happening is that we're making environments more hospitable for the spread of these diseases. And then the way to think about this is that we know that mosquitoes are now increasing their range and their ability to thrive in places of higher latitude. So in the northern hemisphere, they're moving more northerly and higher altitude. For instance, the East African highlands, you know, we know there's data to support that mosquitoes and the diseases that they bring are now encroaching on populations that had historically been naive to diseases like malaria. And so these mosquitoes have warmer temperatures. They are able to have more life cycles within a certain season and are able to proliferate their diseases much more effectively. There might be some variations with this, but again, the larger trends are that these tropical and subtropical diseases are now hitting more and more people. So not only more people, but people that have historically been naive to these diseases. And that brings other problems, too, because, again, populations are not necessarily they don't have immunity built up, and they don't necessarily have the infrastructure or the behavior adaptations as people that have lived with it their entire lives. So it's basically we're seeing more susceptible populations to these diseases.
I was surprised to see a chapter on algae in your book. I didn't realize that that was totally climate related. What's that about?
Well, harmful algae blooms are a couple things. One, we have warmer water temperatures, which allow algae to thrive in places that maybe they historically haven't. And then you have extreme precipitation events. And what that can do is it can mobilize nutrient runoff. And that's maybe a little bit separate from climate change, but it's all sort of related in sort of our ecosystem use. And so you can imagine a big rainstorm hitting in the upper Midwest, for instance, and then huge amounts of runoff from agricultural nutrients dump into, say, Lake Erie. Warmer temperatures all combine to allow algae to basically have a big party and proliferate. You have what's called a harmful algae bloom. Not only does it devastate the local ecosystem, but through this, we know we have some of the scariest toxins ever known to humans. I mean, there's scary things like amnestic shellfish poisoning, which sounds like a soap opera plot, but it's really, you know, it's devastating. It's like a stroke where you can get affected and it can affect certain parts of your brain where you have memory problems moving forward. Neurotoxins, liver toxins from these. And, you know, these aren't things that affect, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, but man, when these happen, you know, the scores of people that are affected, you know, are devastating illnesses. And again, we're seeing more of them encroach in places that have historically been immune because they've been colder areas. Now we're seeing tropical and subtropical diseases affecting more northern, at least in the northern hemisphere, more northern climates.
I'm starting to hear a lot more talk about the mental health impacts of climate change, and I was pleased to see you've got a chapter on that in your book. And I don't think, personally, I don't think that it's limited to people who are actually traumatized by a superstorm or a flood. You don't have to be in it. I think others get discouraged or worried just by the weather news that they see popping up all over the world and the threats of a more dangerous future. What do you think?
You know, they're existential. It's hard to get your hands around. It's hard for one person to feel empowered to change it. It almost seems inevitable or fatalistic in the sense that we're sort of doing a slow march off a cliff. That's what a lot of the news focuses on. And I think you're right. I think it's very scary, but I also think we have plenty of time to change. It doesn't take that much. It just, you know, what we hope to do with the book is really just change our risk assessment. If people understand that the risks affect the health of their loved ones and their children and themselves, then they can go into conversations with a little bit more knowledge. And then you'll go back to their own constituencies, whether they be liberal or conservative, and say, hey, you know what? We've got to change the way we do business in a thoughtful way, but at least they have a better sense of the risk. You know, unfortunately, right now, there's way too many people, certainly in the United States, who just don't think that this is our own fault, right? So if half the people in the room don't think there's a problem, you just have no chance of solving the problem. That was really the point of our book, is to, again, frame it in terms of health risk so people could easily understand it and then move forward to solutions.
Well, even the hospitals that we count on are kind of targets. I mean, we've seen hospitals just this year that were emptied out due to flooding, due to wildfires, or the power goes off, as happened in Puerto Rico. What do hospitals have to do to prepare and adapt to climate change?
Yeah, right. You know, excellent point. You know, one of the things we talk about is that even in the most resource-rich places in the United States, you think of New York and Superstorm Sandy, it was an extreme precipitation event that led to storm surge in the East River that took Bellevue Hospital and NYU Tisch Hospital offline. Those are places I actually trained there. And they were, parts of the hospitals were offline for the better part of a year. That can be devastating to a community, particularly Bellevue's mission to take care of the homeless and the prisoners and the immigrants. You know, these are very vulnerable populations that lose their primary healthcare system or, you know, big disruptions in it. So hospitals, all infrastructure can be very vulnerable. And you ask how to prepare for it. I mean, it's difficult, right? Because we're seeing things now that we've never seen before, historical anomalies happening in terms of weather. You know, this was something we talk a lot about, is the heat wave in 2003 in Paris. You know, I think 12,000 people perished. And again, climate change wasn't the sole cause, but it was certainly a contributor. And perhaps the better lesson is to say, we'll be seeing a lot more of these historical anomalies in the future. And the lessons learned are, You know, we're just going to have to be more heads up and prepared for weather and extreme events that we just haven't had in our in a particular geographic area.
Yeah, that whole French and European heat wave was just an amazing thing for all of us to see. Developed countries have so many deaths, and I recall news of hospitals in Pakistan filling up this year during a super heat wave. And I wonder, are our emergency wards even beginning to be prepared for that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think most people don't get it, frankly, sadly. I think we're very slow to understand that this is a big risk factor in terms of preparedness. You know, some of the big insurance companies are starting to get there. And remember, these are companies that have to justify to their clients why they're charging more. They're incorporating climate models into their risk assessments. So the market is beginning to support this, these risk assessments. But I think in terms of healthcare, the conversations aren't there yet. And I think we're starting to turn the corner on that one. But really, as of today, there's still a lot of work to be done.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith from the University of Colorado. My guest is Dr. Jay Lemery. We're covering his new book, Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. And I've heard you ask, Jay, where are the clinicians saying there's a conspicuous absence of healthcare providers going public on climate, on clean air, and all that? How can we change, say, medical education to bring up climate-aware doctors? That's what we need now.
Yeah, it's something we've spent a lot of time on. You know, the medical school curriculum is extremely crowded, right? There's just so much that needs to be learned in med school. But what we're trying to do is create easy ways for climate and health issues to be plugged in. We have a textbook. I have a textbook separate from this book on the topic with a full curriculum and, you know, making it very easy for young professors to sort of pick up this topic and interject it. I think what's really most encouraging, though, is that the students really want this. The old guard, as I say, which I'm slowly becoming one of them, we're somewhat ossified in the way we do business, but it's the students who are looking around and seeing the headlines and saying, why aren't we learning more about this? So when we actually have in our school at the University of Colorado sessions on climate and health, I mean, they're packed and the students can't get enough of it, which is encouraging. But I think we have to scale that up, obviously, and make sure that we're getting this into medical education throughout the world, because it's so important to have clinicians who are facile and fluent on these issues and to give some context, you know, not just for their patients, but also for their organizations and colleges. And really, you know, doctors still have a lot of power within their own constituencies to influence opinion. And I think that's something that we talk a lot about is, you know, don't think of yourself as a pediatrician or an ER doc or an internist. Think of yourself as a physician wearing the white coat, because you have a lot of influence, and that's a very powerful fulcrum to affect change.
Well, yeah, you have brought up the example of Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, who told world leaders that a nuclear war is not treatable. I mean, it's a catastrophe well beyond any response. Talk to us about the similarities of that to where we are now with climate change.
Right, excellent. So, you know, it was when you think about the Cold War, and it was in the early 80s when the doctrine got tweaked to the Cold War rhetoric, rather, that was nuclear wars are winnable, right? Very scary. And it was physicians from both sides of the Iron Curtain that got together and said, hang on, nuclear war is the final epidemic with no meaningful cure. Very powerful. And it was unimpeachable. They came in from a healthcare perspective. And because of that, you know, they had a very powerful voice that resonated and, you know, was attributed to contributing to the demise of the Cold War. I think we're in a similar place. I think when you think about, you know, nuclear Armageddon, right? It's scary, it's politicized, it's existential. It's very difficult to understand how one individual can affect change. But I think we're looking at a very similar opportunity. And I think if you frame it from a healthcare perspective, then it's something people can really wrap their hands around, understand the risks, and, you know, move forward to affect change. You know, I think the parallels are very important to see that, because it was successful in many ways, and I think it's important to have some success stories that, you know, we can look at to say, hey, you know, this is not inevitable. We can still change things.
And I totally agree. And so now we need maybe International Physicians for the Prevention of Climate Change. Is the medical profession organizing in the United States and around the world?
There's some. I mean, there's Physicians for Social Responsibility that are doing, you know, incredible work in this sector. There's Healthcare Without Harm, which is a group that says, hey, let's get our own house in order. You know, healthcare, at least in the United States, being 18% of GDP, saying, hey, we're a huge chunk of the economy that's incredibly wasteful. I mean, I know that just from working in hospitals. And then there's something called the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health. And that is a effort out of led by friends at George Mason University who are trying to get the different colleges, so obstetrics and gynecology, pediatrics, even sports medicine, emergency medicine, around the table and say, hey, we're all the colleges for these physicians' specialties. Let's start to come together and focus on climate and health. And we've had a very positive start to that. It's only about a year old. So we're getting there. I do think it's a question of infiltrating the mainstream. I think that that's where we are now, as opposed to saying, you know, individual physicians self-selecting and coming together in a separate society. I think we have to bring this messaging into the mainstream medical education, and then after that into the mainstream colleges, which is how physicians are organized.
When a doctor, Jay, sees people made sicker or even dying, maybe partly due to climate change, is it radical or is it part of the Hippocratic Oath to become a climate activist as well?
I mean, it's an excellent question, right? I think any care provider needs to look around at the drivers of disease. And that's really where we come in, is to say, hey, look, we know sickness. This is sickness. The data may be incomplete, but then again, all data in science and medicine is incomplete. But you do your best. When you see a problem, you look at it face value and you begin to affect reasonable change. If the data changes, then medicine changes. But we're just not seeing that yet, and I don't think we will with climate change. I think the data every year is getting more precise and is reinforcing what we already know. And because of that, I think every care provider has to look at the data and say, look, this is a driver of disease, and it will be a major driver in very significant ways for many, many decades. And because of that, then I think it's important for us to have a reasonable conversation, you know, as healthcare providers, and then, you know, do what we do, which is to present the best data and let the policymakers move forward, but with a very clear voice from the healthcare community that this is just dangerous to our health.
But you never know what other people's political or even religious beliefs might be. Is it a little awkward for doctors and patients to talk about climate change as part of their health?
Right. So I think for doctors to talk about it, no. I mean, because that's what we do. We talk about health. Now, you know, when we start to frame it as in politics or religion, I would actually say that I don't really care what one's politics or religion is, because just like if you have risk factors for heart disease, that has really no part of the conversation when we are, you know, we're making diagnosis and treatment plans. So I think it's the same thing in that regard.
You know, we started out talking about your roots in wilderness medicine, and I meant to ask you, do you think that wilderness medicine could help in a chaotic situation like Puerto Rico or maybe the earthquake in Haiti?
Of course, yeah. So, you know, there's a whole field of humanitarian response and disaster training and disaster management. And so those fields are, they're relatively new, but there's some real, the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of momentum in the development of those fields. Wilderness medicine, certainly, there's tons of providers who are trained in wilderness medicine. It's just basically how do you take care of people in remote and austere places. And so that expertise absolutely plugs into humanitarian disaster response. And there's a lot of people who have overlap in those two fields. In fact, a lot of colleagues I know have been down in the Caribbean working as DMAT teams or in public health efforts to better characterize and understand, you know, the vulnerabilities that have happened in the Caribbean.
Should we just leave it to the doctors? Should we all learn a little bit about how to, you know, patch up a broken bone so you can make it back out, or how to maybe use some of those herbs that are growing right around you?
I think there's always a good. In fact, we have lots of people who take our courses who are lay people, you know, a weekend course is in wilderness first aid. Those are great things for families going out camping into the backcountry to keep themselves and their families safe. And they're good skills to have for just disaster resiliency, right? That we know FEMA often talks about having a disaster pack in your home. I mean, those are all good ideas. So I would always encourage people that are interested. You know, there's tons of courses online from many different providers, and we certainly do a lot in Colorado.
I was trying to figure out the public for your book, EnviroMedics. Do you see it as a textbook for university students and doctors, or is it open enough for all of our listeners to get something from it?
Yeah, we wrote it for all listeners. It's written for lay people. We did a basic inventory of the best science that's out there, you know, in terms of how climate change is affecting health. And then we put in clinical vignettes so we could really share with you what it feels like to take care of these pathologies. And the point is that we'll be seeing a lot more of these pathologies with the way we're headed. So it's not a textbook. It's an easy read. And we wanted to make it very accessible. And for those that are interested, you know, we have other textbooks available for universities and medical school and public health schools.
Yeah, what's the title of your new textbook?
So it's actually, you know, it's a couple years old. It's called Global Climate Change and Human Health from Science to Practice. It's available through Josie Bass, who's a big public health publisher out of San Francisco.
Well, I know that Nick Watts from the prestigious medical journal The Lancet highly recommends your new book, EnviroMedics, and I'll be talking with Nick soon. He was off at the Bonn climate talks and said, can we wait till after that? So I'm looking forward to that talk. It does sound like there's at least a wave of climate awareness emerging out of the medical community, and I think that's a really hopeful sign.
Yeah, I mean, Nick and Hugh Montgomery and The Lancet folks have been truly leading the charge on this, at least in the academic field. They're way ahead of the game, and you know, the Lancet Countdown is an outstanding resource and very well done and meticulously, you know, annotated with the best science that's available. So I'd encourage anyone who's interested to look at the Lancet Countdown and the work that they're doing. But yeah, I mean, I think we're starting to see movement in that direction. There's just a ton of work to be done, and you know, the vast majority of healthcare providers are still, you know, they're uncertain and not educated on this. And, you know, the same with vast swaths of the public. And I think if, you know, from where I sit is if we can get healthcare providers to weigh in on the best science, then we can change our risk assessment. And then we can have meaningful policy. Look, I understand, you know, there's energy policy is important. People have jobs tied up in them. That's all totally understood. You know, from my point of view, it's we have to just understand the risks. If you don't understand the risks, then, you know, then we're all kind of flying in the blind and can't have meaningful conversations. So that's the goal of this book, is just to change the conversation.
We have been talking with Dr. Jay Lemry, the emergency specialist and wilderness medicine expert from the University of Colorado School of Medicine, with co-author Dr. Paul Auerbach from Stanford. He's just published a necessary new book titled EnviroMedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. I will put links to it in my blog at ecoshock.org, and you can find a lot more at the book website at www.enviromedics.org. Jay Lemry, thank you so much for being our climate emergency doctor here on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Nick Watts from The Lancet agreed to an interview for Radio EcoShock, but he was away at the Bonn Climate Talks. I tried to nab him right after, but got an email back saying Nick was now in remote Nepal with no phone connection. He recommended the Climate Countdown Program Officer, Nicola Wheeler. And here she comes.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Has your doctor talked to you about the health risk of climate change? According to one of the world's leading medical journals, she or he should. It's all in a big new report called The Lancet Countdown 2017. The British-based publication The Lancet has organized a global body of doctors, scientists, and public policy experts to calculate Where we are now on the road to either climate tragedy or survival. From the University College London, we've reached the Lancet Countdown Project Officer, Nicola Wheeler. Nicola, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Well, of course, to let listeners know why this matters, we do have to begin with at least one dire projection from the 2017 report. Could you give us a snapshot of increasing heat?
Yeah, of course. So one of the indicators that we look at is exposure to heat wave among vulnerable populations. That's people over 65 years old who are especially vulnerable to the health effects of heat waves. And what we find is that already since the year 2000, 125 million additional people are being exposed to heat waves. And in 2015 alone, this was 175 million additional vulnerable people that were exposed to heat waves just in 2015 alone.
That's hundreds of millions of people exposed to heat waves more than previously. What did the Lancet project find out about the loss of labor productivity?
Yeah, so we looked at rural populations that were exposed to changing temperatures. And between 2000 and 2016, we found that people's capacity to do labor and to do labor activities productively had decreased by 5.3% just in those 16 years.
Sometimes factories have to shut down due to heat and other factors. What about the lost productivity in manufacturing and other sectors? Is something being done to gather that data?
Yeah, it's a really good point, and it's something that we really are looking to capture next year. We're already developing our 2018 indicators, looking at how we can improve our existing ones, and even any new indicators to capture information that we haven't yet presented in 2017. And in terms of labor capacity, things like that, like manufacturing, building work, that's all something that we're hoping to build into the report next year.
I was struck by the doctor's view of climate change as a medical issue. Despite the continuing work by The Lancet, we have not heard enough about this. Most of us are not yet hearing it from our doctors. Why not?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And we are increasingly hearing from doctors about the risks of climate change to our health. But you're right, it's not enough yet. That's kind of why this project is so important, is improving our understanding of how climate change is affecting our health and enabling doctors to bring that information to their patients. You know, doctors are a really powerful advocate for health issues. I mean, tobacco is a brilliant example of that. But ultimately, they need really good, solid evidence in order to back the agenda and to explain to patients and to policymakers why climate change matters and why it matters to our health.
Well, it's almost like tobacco. I mean, people are dying about it, so we need to talk about it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Before we go further, what is The Lancet and why is the medical community reporting on climate change?
Sure. So The Lancet is the world's leading independent general medical journal. It aims to improve physicians' clinical practice and their knowledge by bringing novel and innovative research on medical issues directly to physicians. So if you go to any kind of hospital, any doctor's office, they will have a copy of The Lancet in there. So it's a fantastic way to get directly to doctors and to explain these issues to them. In terms of why The Lancet is interested in climate change, it's recognised for a while now the kind of huge threats that climate change poses to human health. But also conversely, that if we address climate change, the opportunities that that has for improving health globally. So it's been doing this for quite a few years, like I say. It launched its first kind of detailed research project into health and climate change back in 2009. And since then, it's just been building and building on this agenda. And that's where we've landed now with the Lancet Countdown, where the Lancet is now supporting us to every year report on these health and climate change indicators to really build on that evidence year on year.
When was the Lancet founded?
It was founded back in the 1800s. So it's been around for a couple of hundred years now.
Right. It's one of the originals. So science suggests that Hurricane Maria was a natural disaster made worse by climate change, especially warming seas adding to storm strength. How do you see the collapse of hospitals in Puerto Rico in light of your 2017 Lancet report?
Yeah, I mean, really, that disaster just highlights why we need to be looking at this issue and why health systems, they need to be prepared. And they're currently, a lot of health systems are very ill-prepared for disasters such as Hurricane Maria. And ultimately, they need help. They need climate forecasting so they can anticipate and plan for these climate-related disasters. They need climate-resilient infrastructure so when their power systems go down, they have backup generators to ensure they can continue, you know, delivering healthcare, basic healthcare. And ultimately, they need the resource and capacity to undertake all of this work. But I think a really important point, I mean, this all sounds like it costs a lot of money and it's going to be a huge burden on the health system. Actually, it's not. These all are good, common-sense things to do regardless of climate change. All that climate change is doing is just is making these issues more urgent. It's highlighting why health systems need to be prepared for these kind of events.
And what about emissions from the healthcare sector itself? Are they significant and what could be done to reduce them?
Yeah, they are significant. And I think there's kind of two primary reasons why we want to look at the emissions from the healthcare sector. The first is related to your earlier question of why doctors should be advocates on this. And ultimately, if doctors are talking about climate change impacting human health, the health sector as a whole needs to demonstrate that they're behind it and they're doing their part to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. The second issue is, yes, the health sector, they are a significant contributor themselves. If you look at the US health sector emissions, they alone are greater than the entire greenhouse gas emissions from the UK and represent sort of nearly 10% of US emissions. So these are big numbers we're talking about here.
Many of us dread the spread of tropical diseases like dengue fever to the United States or Europe. But this Lancet report adds a hidden burden of non-communicable diseases increasing under climate stress. Please take a little time to tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. It's a really good point, and it's one that we are hoping to do a lot more work in, actually, in 2018 and the years going forward to highlight just how much climate change can impact non-communicable diseases. A great example is looking at air pollution. Air pollution is related to climate change in kind of two key ways. So the first of which is that air pollution results from the burning of fossil fuels. When coal is burnt, it releases greenhouse gas emissions, also reduces particulate matter and other really nasty chemicals, which really exacerbate local air pollution. And we see that all over the world. And the second issue is that as our climate warms and we are exposed to more heat waves, that also worsens local air pollution. So you see a rise in ozone levels, which has really severe effects on human health. Kind of in terms of non-communicable diseases, the main things we see are things like lung cancer, really, you know, severe illnesses, which ultimately can result in people dying.
Yes, last week we talked with Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii, and he'd done some research into heat effects on the body. And he said that a lot of organs can be affected, including, I think he said, the liver. And then the person can die years later from the heat wave that happened.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So one of the things you do see with heat waves is their bodies become stressed. Their bodies function best at their core temperatures, which is 37.5 degrees. And as soon as heat rises above that and it's stayed above that, bodies, they can't cope. They can't maintain their core body temperature and they can't cool down ultimately. And one of the effects you see, for example, is kidney disease. People become dehydrated and their kidneys, they cannot function as they should.
Well, these days we hear less about mass famine, but doctors do warn about undernutrition. Nicola, what is that and how does climate change play into undernutrition?
Yes, undernutrition in the most basic sense is when people simply cannot get enough nutritious food to live a healthy lifestyle. In terms of climate change, ultimately, climate change can affect the food security of people. And we see this most commonly in low and middle income countries where people are more reliant on subsistence farming, so, you know, growing their own food, and they don't have the option of importing food from other countries. It's all very locally produced. And what we see in the paper is that between 1990 and 2016, the number of undernourished people has increased by 24 million. And this is in countries that are particularly vulnerable to climate change, so where we're seeing increased drought, increased heat waves, and in places where people are already particularly vulnerable to undernutrition itself. And also, these are in places, like I say, where they are dependent on local regional food production.
And I was surprised to read in the countdown that doctors are concerned about the statistics of red meat production and consumption. Why is that?
Yeah, so there's kind of two reasons for that, really. The first is related solely to the production side. So the livestock sector is a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions globally. It's about 14%. And of that 14%, cattle production alone is responsible for 65%. So these are, in itself, in the production, it's a huge contributor to climate change, but also in terms of consumption of red meat. Although it can be an important source of protein for some populations, overeating red meat actually poses quite a few significant health risks to people.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from University College London. My guest is Nicola Wheeler. She's the program officer for a huge running project by the leading medical journal, The Lancet. The medical community is tracking climate threats. Nicola, I'd like to pick up on one unusual item in this report, the possibility of ice crash disasters flooding out the billions of people who currently live in coastal cities. What is the warning in the report?
The warning essentially is that we need to be doing more. If we don't significantly mitigate climate change and if we don't put in place adaptation systems that enable people to live in their current environments and protect people against sea level rise, potentially, yeah, we are talking about a billion people that could be forced to leave their homes. I mean, this is, I would like to stress, under circumstances where there is no adaptation in place and, you know, under kind of very bad climate projections, but it's possible. And we're seeing it today. Already people are being forced to leave their homes. In Fiji, they're having to relocate coastal villages to higher land. In Alaska, we see 3,500 people already having been forced to migrate because of changing ice conditions. They simply cannot live where they used to live.
You know, it's just occurred to me it might be helpful for The Lancet to do an inventory of hospitals that would have to move if we had 1 or even 3 meters of sea level rise. Recreating a hospital is not easy or cheap. Would that be worth investigating, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And sea level rise is in itself something that we don't actually have an indicator on at the moment. But like I said, we are looking to expand these indicators and to improve them. So, yeah, that could be certainly something that we look into in future.
Nicola Wheeler, why are doctors calling for a total phase out of coal?
Coal is really important. If there's one thing you can do to quickly help mitigate climate change and to vastly improve population's health around the world, it's phasing out coal. In terms of climate change, coal is responsible for 44% of carbon dioxide emissions globally. And it's also, as we discussed before, it's a major contributor to local air pollution. It emits a lot of particulate matter, which can have really severe pulmonary and cardiovascular health effects upon people.
And yet, it's still being burned in Europe, for example.
It is. It is still being burned. We are seeing positive signs of progress. We last week had the announcement of the Coal Alliance, who are committing to phasing out coal. And we have seen that coal production and investment has peaked. So there are positive signs that we are beginning to move away from this outdated, dirty source of energy. But you're right, we're not there yet, and we need to do more.
I'm sorry, I missed the first thing that you said. An announcement of what?
So the Coal Alliance is a group of countries, including the UK and Canada, who have come together and committed to phasing out coal by 2030.
That would be good. I didn't even know Canada was a part of that, so I'm glad to hear that. I'm from Canada. Has there really been an increase in extreme weather events, or is it just better TV coverage?
There has been an increase, yeah. We find that there's been about a 46% increase in extreme weather events since 2007. Part of that could be down to better reporting, but really since 2007 we've had pretty robust sort of reporting and monitoring systems in place. So that's a huge increase in just 10 years.
According to this report, though, despite the floods and the fires and the heat waves, there's no obvious increase in people dying. Could you explain why?
Yeah, sure. It's actually, we were quite surprised to find that, to be honest. With such a huge increase in the number of extreme weather events, we really thought there'd be a more kind of discernible trend in the number of deaths. But to date, there isn't. However, there are huge and very significant limits to adaptation. So what we think is happening is that at the moment, our response systems are sufficient. We're just able to cope with these extreme weather events. However, that's not going to be able to continue. As these, you know, if these weather events continue to increase at the rate that they have in the past 10 years, we need to significantly upscale our response systems, and we need to make huge adaptation efforts in order to ensure that the number of deaths don't increase in future.
Yes, I think the report does use a medical analogy about this limit to adaptation. I mean, our body can adapt to a certain amount of influx of disease or a virus or something, but at a certain point, we can't cope with it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, our bodies are only able to take so many hits, if you like. And ultimately, it gets to a point where it can't recover. And these systems are exactly the same. If you are dealing with an emergency response system that is constantly or frequently having to deal with these extreme weather events, ultimately, it's going to fall apart. It's not going to be able to deal with those anymore.
And the report suggests that despite some signs of climate action, which are discussed there, we still face warming of 2.6 degrees to 4.8 degrees C by the end of the century. The first is kind of a disaster. The second is definitely a catastrophe. And yet there are several very optimistic passages in this report, including in the conclusion, that seem to clash with those odds. How is that possible?
Yeah, you're right. It is. It's very concerning. And the thing that we highlight is that it's in the last 5 years only that we've seen this kind of increased response to climate change. So, for example, we've seen commitments to new coal power plants have halved just in 2016 to 2017. We've seen that since 2015, in every single year since 2015, there's been more renewable energy added to the global mix than all other sources combined. However, when we look at the big picture, in the last 25 years, our progress has been embarrassingly slow. we're really not doing enough to address this. And that's why we say, although there's kind of glimmers of hope, if you like, that in the last 5 years we're beginning to do more, and perhaps this is the start of a transition to a low carbon world, we're not there yet. And we need to do an awful lot more in order to meet the Paris Agreement goals of, you know, keeping global temperatures below 2 degrees, let alone 1.5 degrees.
Well, as you said, the 2017 Lancet Countdown report also suggests that low and middle income countries will be hit hardest. But isn't that partly because population is expanding in regions that are already climate stressed?
It is partly to do with that. So the heat waves indicators that I mentioned earlier, a large portion of where those people are exposed is in India, where we see a huge rise in population. So it is partly due to that, but it's also partly due to, it just so happens that in countries that are least able to adapt, least able to cope with these extreme weather events, that's where these events are occurring.
You know, I think a lot of us think that with our good healthcare systems and with air conditioners, we're invulnerable to climate challenges. And do you think that people in developed countries are going to get a free pass?
No, absolutely not. We've already seen, so in Europe in 2003, over 70,000 people died during that summer when there was one of the most severe heat waves that's ever hit the continent. And quite simply, the health systems, they weren't prepared for it. They'd never dealt with anything like it before. And although they are, you know, they're starting to implement systems that are in place, ultimately they're going to have to deal with a lot more than just the occasional heat wave. And our results, we look at our countries implementing projects to improve their climate resilience. And actually, we're finding that the majority are not. Health systems simply aren't ready to cope with climate change. And actually, that's not just the case in low and middle income countries. That really is the case in high income countries, too.
Could you help us understand how this report fits in context with ongoing work by the Lancet and a view of how all this will be followed up in the future? What is the plan and the process?
Sure. So in terms of the Lancet Countdown, we will be re-evaluating these indicators every single year between now and 2030. And what that will enable us to do is to every year build on this evidence of not looking 10, 20, 50 years in the future of how climate change is affecting the health of populations, but actually today, how it is already affecting human health. In terms of the broader picture of what the Lancet is doing, the Lancet is increasingly looking at not just climate change, but also this concept of planetary health, so how the health of humans is influenced by every environmental determinant.
But that is a huge project to keep track of all these indicators. How do you do it?
Yeah, so we have over 24 partners globally from every continent around the world. You know, we're working with the best people in the world, with experts from geographers, from climate modelers, economists, doctors, kind of every discipline you could think of, really. When we say it's multidisciplinary, we really do mean it.
This is almost like the Intergovernmental Panel reports, except that it's coming from the medical community.
I mean, that's very kind of you to say, yeah. I mean, it'd be wonderful if we could be something like that.
So how can people read this report for themselves or refer their doctors to it?
Sure. So you'll be able to find it on the Lancet website, or alternatively, you can go to www.lancetcountdown.org, and on that website, there'll be a link to the report.
And anybody can read it?
Anybody can read it. It's free to read.
Great. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about, Nicola?
I suppose one other final thing to maybe say is that we have also, alongside this main global report, we've produced a series of national policy briefs. So what these policy briefs do is that they look at, in particular countries, for example, the US, they draw out indicators that are particularly relevant to that country, and they tell that national story, and they provide policy recommendations for those countries. And they're also available on that website. So that's another great resource if you want to know more about these issues.
We've been talking about climate and health, the big picture, from the medical community called The Lancet. Our guest is Project Officer Nicola Wheeler. Nicola, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Here is a simple action you can take to help the planet a little bit. Please send a link to this radio program to your doctor, or a link to one of these interviews. There are the links to help you do just that in my weekly show blog. That's published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Tell your doctor, climate change isn't healthy for anyone. It kills. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and please join us again next week.